Our docket is People of the State of Colorado versus Homaiden Alturkey. This is case number 06CA2104. As soon as council are set up and we're ready to go, we'll be ready. You ready?
Yes.
Counsel, please proceed.
May it please the court, counsel, my name is Harold Haddon, number 1597. I appear on behalf of the appellant, Homaiden Alturkey. We've assigned discussed in our briefs five significant errors that all require reversal. Three of them have jeopardy consequences. I don't think beyond a reasonable doubt that I can discuss them all in much coherent detail, but I, with your leave, will start in the same order that we briefed them, and be happy to segue into other issues if any of the judges would like me to. As we've indicated in our briefs, there were significant errors, both singly and cumulatively, in the jury selection in this case, one of which plainly requires reversal, two of which on a cumulative basis also compel, we submit, reversal. And the issue that is plainest both in the jurisprudence of this court and on the record in this case is that one of the jurors, a juror who was actually seated and who at first declined to take the oath, should have been excused for cause. And under these circumstances, a bright line of cases from this court require reversal for a new trial. Those cases are the Lumen case, which Your Honor, Judge Marcus participated in 1999, the Wilson case in 2004, which is important because it enunciates a very bright line position that whenever a prospective juror expresses doubt in the language of the case about that juror's ability to fairly serve in a case, that juror must be stricken on a challenge for cause unless there is adequate rehabilitation, where a juror indicates on the record that that juror can be fair and impartial.
Is this juror CM that you're
That's juror CM,
to?
Yes. The juror who was seated after the defense was out of challenges for cause and who initially declined to take the oath because, in his words, after the trial court told him that despite his views on the Muslim religion, he had a duty to decide the case on the evidence, juror CM then said, and it's something we've underscored in our briefs, notwithstanding that, in other words, notwithstanding that Your Honor has told me I have to decide the case on the evidence and on the law, given my views on the Muslim religion in a he said, she said situation, the juror's words, I would be inclined not to credit the defendant because of his religion. I'm paraphrasing the last part, but those words that...
You are paraphrasing. It says I may or may not. My bias may be altered. It's not a clear indication, is it, or is
Well, that's
it
an either? Indication in the context of what he said earlier, that he has a bias. It's a religious bias. He says that notwithstanding the court's statement that based on the evidence presented, he has to decide the case regardless of religion, his answer then is, what I say, notwithstanding the facts presented, it came to a situation where it was a he said, she said issue. My bias may be altered based on the belief he would be obeying religion rather than law. In other words, he's expressing a bias based upon religion.
Exactly. My bias may be altered.
And he's expressing doubt, as the Wilson case highlights. And once he expresses doubt, the trial court then clearly, under the Lumen case, under the Wilson case, and under the Merrow case, which was very recently decided by this court in mid-2007, under those circumstances, a trial judge or the prosecutor is required to rehabilitate the juror at least to the point where the trial judge gives an assurance that the juror will try to be fair and impartial. That didn't happen here. And as a matter of fact, quite the contrary, the juror initially refused to take the oath, reluctantly took it, only being after being told by the trial court that he had to do it. And under those circumstances, I submit that the cases, the clear settled law in this jurisdiction require reversal on that ground alone. In this situation, we have to compound the problem, and probably what caused the problem was the trial court's limitation on voir dire. The parties, as we've indicated in our briefs, stipulated to a procedure where 25 jurors would be placed in the well of the court, questioned, and then as jurors were excused, others would be questioned, so it would allow sufficient time for juror questioning. The trial court rejected that procedure and instead required the entire panel, which after initial questioning consisted of 97 jurors, required the entire panel to be questioned by both sides within 45 minutes aside. Under these circumstances, as defense counsel pointed out, there simply wasn't sufficient time using a numbering system from 1 to 97 to get to a number of jurors whose biases may or may not have disqualified them. Juror CM also said in his questionnaire he had issues arising from a sexual assault of a friend or acquaintance or relative that he couldn't discuss in open court, yet he was not allowed to be questioned in camera about that. The record is silent on why that is. The trial judge did indicate that he was going to do in-camera questioning at the lunch hour, but that didn't happen. And so you have a whole body of jurors who were never questioned about bias in a case which poses profound possible issues concerning juror bias, both in terms of religion and religious aptitude, and in terms of experiences with sexual assault.
Didn't the trial court's questionnaire inquire of the prospective jurors whether or not they would have a bias or a prejudice because of the influence or because of this case involving Muslims or the Islamic religion?
The question didn't ask about bias and prejudice. I don't want to parse it, but the words are important. The question said, the questionnaire said, in this case, the defendant, many of the witnesses and the complaining witnesses are Muslim. What is your reaction to that? And juror CM and a number of other jurors either didn't say anything or said none. And then there was generic questioning of the jury. Not a lot of response, but some verbal response. What the Merrill case teaches, and I think the Merrill case is important in this regard.
Is that in your brief?
Yes, M-E-R-R-O-W. It was cited by a panel of this court in 2007.
And how did you spell that? I'm sorry.
M-E-R-R-O-W.
Thank you.
And what the Merrill court teaches is that where there's a general voir dire, where all the principles of criminal law are explained and jurors are asked whether or not they can be fair and impartial and whether or not they will put aside their biases, and no jurors respond, that does not foreclose the issue of potential bias, because when later a juror actually speaks, as happened in the Merrill case, and expresses doubt about his or her ability to be fair, at that point in time, the trial judge and the prosecutor have a duty to inquire and determine whether or not that juror will give affirmative assurances of fairness. Absent such assurances, the teaching in Luhmann and Wilson and Merrill is that you must reverse and remand for a new trial.
It's my recollection in this case that in response to the trial court's generic questioning of the jurors about whether or not they could be completely fair and open-minded and impartial, that there were 8 jurors who responded.
That's correct.
And that those 8 jurors were excused.
That's correct. And juror CM and several of the persons who had been victims of sexual assault did not respond. Mm-hmm. Juror CM had requested that he be questioned in private, but he was not. And I think important to sort of close out my argument on the jury selection point is the overarching due process issue, which we have raised in issues involving significant potential bias on grounds of religion, ethnicity, and sexual assault experience. And that is the due process clause in a clear line of cases, both in Colorado and the United States Supreme Court, requires that there be adequate voir dire to allow counsel to determine whether or not juror bias is present, and in turn determine whether or not challenges for cause and peremptory challenges should be issued on the basis of adequate information. I won't reiterate the cases except to say that we discussed them in depth. The second issue I'd like to address in my time, and I'm going to ask to reserve a couple of minutes, is the issue of the jury instructions. The state concedes, first of all, that there's plain error in the jury verdict forms and in the lack of instruction on the enhanced version of sexual contact, which is what the jury convicted on, not sexual assault. The state concedes that if that error is determined to be plain error, that the Rodriguez case, a 1996 decision of the Colorado Supreme Court, controls, and therefore, as to the sexual contact counts, the enhancements must not only be reversed, but jeopardy applies as to the enhanced version of those counts, and the defendant cannot be retried on the enhanced versions of those counts. The Rodriguez case is a bright line case. The state doesn't argue otherwise. The state argues that this isn't plain error because in this circumstance, the only evidence that the jury could have relied on to find an enhancement was the actual application of physical force. That is simply and overwhelmingly belied by the record in this case. And no intellectually honest review of the record can so conclude. And I just cite the three things that we've discussed this far more extensively in our briefs. But first of all, the fact is that the jury acquitted on every single instance in which the complaining witness claimed that there had been an application of physical force. Secondly, the complaining witness acknowledged that at some point, untethered as to time or count, she did not resist, and there was could not have been the application of physical force. Thirdly, the prosecution throughout its case emphasized not just the actual application of physical force, but also cultural isolation, intimidation in a common meaning sense, but not a statutory sense, in terms of cultural isolation, economic isolation, threats of immigration consequences. And what's important about all this is that the aggravating factors in this case, two of the three of them, intimidation, which is not a word used in the statute, yet it's a word used in the jury verdict forms, undefined by statute. Intimidation requires threat of physical force or reprisal. The prosecution conceded on the record in this case, as we've noted in our briefs, that there was no threat of physical force or reprisal. Similarly, the statutory aggravator threat requires threats of physical reprisal. The prosecution conceded there were no such threats. So on the basis of this record, you cannot conclude that the aggravated forms of these charges were proven. Two of the three of them were concededly not proven. What Rodriguez tells us is that in a case where there's a general verdict form on an enhancement charge, and the jury is not instructed, as it was not here, on one of the three enhancements, that not only is plain error, but it also is error of constitutional magnitude, and it results in a finding of jeopardy as to those enhancements. So I see that I've got a little less than a minute. I'd like to reserve that if I might.
Thank you, Mr. Ed.
May it please the court, Majid Yazdi appearing on behalf of the people in this case. I will address the issues as presented in the brief, starting with the challenges for cause, and specifically with respect to juror CM. As I have pointed out in the answer brief, it is important to place juror CM's comments in the proper context, which is the fact that he was reluctant to serve. He did not make any comments regarding bias prior to his selection as a juror. And even after the selection, as it was pointed out, there was no express expression of actual bias. It is interesting that first it is argued that there was an expression of actual bias, but then Mr. Haddon said, well, there was expression of doubt. Well, obviously these two are inconsistent. But neither one existed, because the beginning of the comments, if the court pays careful attention to that, and that is important because paraphrasing can mislead, the statement is that if there are conflicts between religion and laws, and someone who is religious in general, before even discussing the religion of Islam, if someone believes in following religion in the context of that conflict, then I believe that this person has committed a crime by violating the laws but obeying his religion. That hypothetical scenario was presented to the court, and it doesn't exist here. And the court properly said that if the issue arises in the future, in the course of the proceedings, then we can revisit this issue. But at that point, the court properly clarified the issue. There was no rehabilitation needed because there was no clear expression of actual bias. But the court clarified the issue for juror CM by saying that you are supposed to base your decision on evidence and follow the laws that I instruct you to. And at the end, if we focus on the final response, juror CM said okay and agreed to serve on the jury.
However, before he said that, okay, in response to the court, juror CM said that if it comes to a he said, she said issue, my bias may be altered based on the belief he would be obeying religion versus law. How do you explain that comment, and where was juror CM coming from then with that comment if he was not expressing a bias?
He was coming exactly from the first statement that he made, which I repeat to the court. This is quote, if the faith conflicted with the laws of our government. So if that is the situation here, juror CM was suggesting that if faced with that scenario, then he might be biased against the defendant, because he would assume that even though the laws prohibited him from doing something, but because religious laws allowed him to do it, then he would be following the religious laws. So his bias in that sense would be tilted if there is such a conflict. But as pointed out, there was nothing in the record, there was no testimony that what he did somehow was condoned by Islamic laws. To the contrary, even defense counsel argued that we are not arguing here cultural factors that allow the defendant to commit these. So there was no basis for assuming that there was conflict. And that is why the court or the defense did not raise the issue of conflict of religious laws and criminal laws later on. And that means there was no basis, there was no reason for juror CM to even get to the point of deciding whether he should believe that the defendant has violated just because he followed the religious laws. And Carrillo establishes the standard that unless there is clear expression, the court is not required to remove the juror. Even though, as the court said in Carrillo, the better practice might have been conducting further inquiry, but that was not required, and that the court did not have to rehabilitate juror CM in order to allow him to serve on the jury. On the two jurors who were victims of sexual assault, I just point out, as I've said in the brief, there is no law that says just because a potential juror is a victim of sexual assault that they are disqualified to serve. And that is what the defendant is proposing this court to adopt as a new rule, that the mere fact that someone is a victim of sexual assault should require the court to conduct further inquiry and somehow rehabilitate them. But because there is no actual bias expressed, there is no rehabilitation required. On the time restriction, I just like to point out that Criminal Procedure 24 allows the court, provides the court with significant discretion in terms of how much time to allocate, and here the court, based on the questioners, and specifically two questions on the questioners were submitted by the defense over the prosecution's objection to address the issue of pretrial publicity as well as potential ethnic and religious biases. So if the questions are not clear, as Mr. Haddon said, that they are somehow not specific, it is the defense who submitted those two questions. And the court, based on that information and its own general voir dire, decided at the point that the answers were given by these jurors and reviewed by the court, at that point decided that 45 minutes would be sufficient to address the selection of the jurors. So there is no violation of due process on that basis. And because it was applicable to both sides, it cannot be considered a harmful error because the prosecution had 45 minutes too, so no harm. On the instructional errors, I think Mr. Haddon misspoke by saying that the state concedes plain error. Obviously, we don't concede. Of course, there are several references in the briefs alleging that we have conceded. Here, I like to make it clear that the only concession that we are making is that there were errors in the instruction by not defining those two terms. The terms that were included in the interrogatories were not defined. That's the only error that we are conceding. There are three arguments to make on the instructional errors related to lack of definition for force, intimidation, or threat. The first point I'd like to make is that it is our position that these are alternative theories of liability and enhancement. So any one of these three alternatives that is sufficiently supported by evidence can be used to uphold defendant's conviction. And here, Mr. Haddon disagrees with us by citing Rodriguez and saying that the prosecution was required to prove each alternative enhancement. Obviously, Rodriguez is not valid on this point because it was overruled effectively by Donaway, which overruled James. So because Rodriguez relied on James, on this point it is overruled by Donaway. And as long as there is one theory that is supported by sufficient evidence, that conviction should be upheld. The second point is intimidation and threat. Those two alternative theories are surpluses in this case because there is no evidence in the record related to sexual assault that suggests a defendant in any way intimidated or threatened the victim for the purpose of submission to his sexual abuse.
Do you mean sexual contact or sexual assault?
The charges were sexual assaults.
Right, but the conviction was sexual contact.
As a lesser included offense, unlawful sexual contact.
So the question would be, is there any evidence of threat or intimidation as to sexual contact, wouldn't it be?
It is the same question. In as far as any relationship, any sexual contact, relation between the defendant and the victim There's no basis in the record to conclude that there was any threat or intimidation. And on this, there are many cases that I just point out, Rivas, that I mentioned in the answer brief, that if there are theories that are mere surplusage, it does not invalidate the conviction as long as the conviction is based on the proper theory sufficiently supported by evidence. The third point I'd like to make is the lack of definition for force. Again, actual application of physical force was the only evidence presented at trial as a reason for the victim's submission to defendant's sexual contacts. The defendant presented vivid evidence graphically describing how she resisted these sexual advances, demonstrating for the jury how she had to fight back and how the defendant overcame her resistance from the very beginning. So all the other references to maybe seclusion, barring her from leaving the house, they have nothing to do with this sexual contact issue. They go with the issue of whether she was subjected to false imprisonment and also shows the degree of control that was exercised over her. But they have nothing to do, absolutely nothing to do, and contrary to what Mr. Haddon said, any review of the record shows that they have nothing to do with sexual contacts between the defendant and the victim.
You are agreeing then that there was evidence of threat or intimidation in a general sense? A threat to deport, for example?
To report, exactly, but not for the submission. The statute says
how does a jury separate that out if that's part of the evidence that's presented during the whole case?
It is clear for the jury from the beginning that when the victim explained how this whole process of being subjected to sexual contact and sexual assault started, it was with force. So whether she feared for some other reasons to report it, that doesn't go with into the issue of whether she submitted because of threat. So the jury can clearly establish a difference between lack of courage, maybe, or existence of fear to report, as opposed to when she submitted to the advances, especially with the description of the initial contacts, because that's when the most graphic description of the resistance presented to the jury. So it seems there's no basis for the jury to be misled or confused about what caused submission. And that is the issue before the jury, whether the defendant caused submission by use of threat or intimidation or force. In that context, the only thing that the jury could relate to the cause of submission is actual force. On the question of cause and compel related to the instructional errors, given the 1 minute that I have left, I will address that briefly. Mr. Haddon challenges me for using a dictionary that is 18 years old in suggesting that cause can mean compel. To satisfy this challenge and respond to it, I looked at all the dictionaries, Black's Law Dictionary, since 1951 up to 1990, which is the dictionary that I quote. They all include to compel as a synonym for cause. So I can report to this court that the meaning of cause has not changed between 1990 and between the time that the statute was adopted in 1975 and 1990. So the fact that I presented a dictionary edition in 1990 does not mean that the point is not valid. It is clearly stated in all these dictionaries that to compel is one of the meanings of to cause. See, my time is up. Unless the court has any further questions, I ask the court to affirm defendant's conviction. Thank you, your time.
Thank you, counsel. And thank you both, counsel, for your arguments. The matter will stand submitted. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Yes, you do. I have about 55 seconds. I'm sorry, Mr. Haddon.
I'll take the 55. Thank you.
I want to make just briefly a couple of points. First of all, there's nothing in the briefs that where the state argues that Rodriguez has been overruled. I submit to the contrary that it has not been, and certainly in terms of the principles of jeopardy, where the state concedes that two of the three alternative sexual contact enhancers have not been proven, and there's a general verdict, you have to conclude that there has been jeopardy, and jeopardy bars a retrial as to those enhancers. Secondly, I submit that the evidence of religious and cultural issues was palpable during this trial, throughout this trial, and the juror CM's expression of discomfort about those religious issues had to affect his judgment, as he said he thought it would. So I see that my time too is up. I thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thank you both for your arguments. This matter will now stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course.